For November the 14th, 2014, we talk about Hand of Fate, Majora's Mask 3D, and we ask you about the most empowering moments in games. Welcome to the 83rd level. My name is Cole Ross.
I'm Dennis Furia.
I'm Jell Apprentice.
Not David Moneysmith, and I'm Ben Merkel.
And you are listening to The Level. It's a podcast for people who love video games. Thank you so much for joining me, everybody on the show here today. Thank you for filling in for David Jala. And thank you to all of the listeners.
Hey guys!
Listeners. Yeah.
Hi, hopefully not mom listening to this, but
yeah. But Ben, do you want me to draw attention to the fact that the day this comes out is your birthday?
I guess you. I don't know how I can answer that question.
So. Yeah. See, now I'm putting you in the position to force me to edit it out.
I'm just plead the fifth on this one, and I'll say no comment.
Okay. Ben, Ben's being modest. He's 80 today. Let's all congratulate him. It's a wonderful milestone.
80 years young. Mm-hmm. Doesn't look a day over 40. No. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know how much preamble I want to do on this. I think I want to get right to talking about games and stuff. Has anybody had a remarkable week?
I like just roasting Ben and getting into things.
Okay, cool. Yeah, let's all take a couple of shots at Ben.
Aww.
And Ben can take a couple of shots. And everything will be okay.
Oh, and then everything's going to be okay. Yeah. So I don't know. Why don't I just billboard this thing? We've got the usual retinue of features and stuff. Got the brief where we're talking about the news. We got the multiplayer where we're talking to you, and we got the grind where we're talking to each other about games. Let's do it.
Go.
But I was gonna say the first shot will be NyQuil, and I won't make the second shot.
Well, no, I was talking about you should take ZQuil. The NyQuil's going to tear your liver up. No, I was talking about like working your kidneys over.
Oh, well, shots. Yeah, sure.
One of your shots. I'm okay. Talking about my shots.
Okay, cool.
we're gonna jump out, Ben. David tried to leave and didn't make it. So
yeah. just trying to make it. That's like a Raymond Carver story. Like you're just getting drunk so everybody can punch you. So it's time for the brief where we talk about things that are happening in the world of video games. Do you guys mind if I lead? Because there's a story I'm very excited about.
Yeah, go.
Okay, I'm going to do this. This happened last week, so it's old news by the time you're hearing this. However, it happened since we recorded last, so whatever. No, Nintendo, at their November Nintendo Direct event, announced that much like they remade the Ocarina of Time for the 3DS, they are now working on The Legend of Zelda Majora's Mask 3D, which is going to be coming out this coming spring.
Nice.
Yeah. So I'm super excited about that because Majora's Mask is one of my favorite Zelda games. I like it because it is weird and off-putting. And they are they're saying that it is not going to be just a simple remake. That they're going to be adding some new stuff to it, which is to be expected. They enhanced the Ocarina of Time, more than they otherwise would have if they were just doing a straight re-release. So this is going to be like a vague remastering of it. And I'm happy about this because it'll bring some attention to the weird bastard stepchild of the series.
So Zelda is a weird blind spot for me. What makes it the weird bastard stepchild?
It fucks with the structure. Okay. A little bit, insofar, and it's a thing that a lot of people hate about it. And the first thing that they'll bring up is the time cycle. So the premise is that the moon is dropping onto this crazy alternate Hyrule kingdom, and it is dropping over the course of 3 in-game days that amounts to about 45 minutes a cycle. And it's up to you to accomplish as much as you can in that 45 minutes before you ultimately have to play a song that rewinds time back to the beginning of the 3 days. And kind of resets some stuff, but you know, some of the progress that you make and the things that you do carries over from cycle to cycle. And eventually you get the ability to like hold on to your bombs and items and stuff. So I like it because of that, you know, like ebb and flow. I think by the time it came out, I had already caught wise to the Zelda formula. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, having just played a tremendous amount of Ocarina of Time and really enjoyed Link's Awakening and Link to the Past, and taking that and seeing something incredibly different before they decided to fall back into a lot of the similar structures again. Right.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah. It's also weird and depressing. I keep on saying weird, but like there are just plot lines that are like, if you just watch the trailer for this, it's crazy how offbeat it is. And I don't know if I can quantify. There's no real point of reference for what it emulates or mimics, but it is unabashedly kind of confrontational with like the darkest, weirdest aspects of what a Nintendo game can be.
I think the moon alone by itself kind of gives a good feel for the game.
Yeah, they made it creepier.
Yep.
in the remake.
Snow 50s movie moon was nice and happy and smiling.
Yeah.
Straight creeping on Earth.
Yeah, it's straight leering with its big old teeth and laser eyes. Yeah. I don't know. So I'm excited about this. I never played the 3DS remake of Ocarina of Time. Well, I played it very briefly, but not all the way through. But I'm probably going to dive headfirst into this because I love it. Jala, do you have any experience with this? You didn't sound off on it.
Oh, no. I'd heard that they were remaking that, but I actually hadn't played the original. Insofar as Zelda games are concerned, I played the original NES games and then Link to the Past and then some of the Game Boy games, but I didn't actually play like any of the other ones, so I have nothing to say, really.
So you never jumped into 3D Zeldas?
Mm-mm.
Right. Okay. Yeah, so that's my story. I'm going to throw off to Ben.
All right. So my story is that Just Cause 3 will not have any microtransactions. Yay. Just Cause 3, you might ask about.
You're kind of burying the lead there.
Yeah, I know. So the bigger story is that they announced that Just Cause 3 is coming out in 2015 for Xbox One and PS4. Hmm. And I think the last one came out in 2009, 2010, one of those 2 years.
Yeah, it so was like mid to late cycle. Let's just say mid cycle 360 era.
Yeah, I know what year was based on the house that I was living on when I played it. So yeah. I'm pretty sure it's 2009, 2010. But yeah, so it's been about 4 or 5 years since the game. I know I jumped pretty deep into Just Cause 2, so I'll probably do the same thing with the third one. Maybe we'll see.
Mm-hmm.
The only details that they released so far were kind of reactionary. They released a screenshot and people thought that there were going to be microtransactions in the game or it was and kind of free to play elements. And so they came out and said that that was not going to be the case, that it was going to be a standalone game and that they will probably be working on DLC afterwards. But it is not going the way of Plants vs. Zombies.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Did they give any indication of if they're leaning into kind of the craziness from 2?
They said that the game will be huge, fully packed, and extremely rewarding experience right out of the gate. So,
so they said nothing.
Yeah, but
basically,
I mean, if it's anything like Just Cause 2, then I imagine the map will be quite large and. Yeah.
The only reason that I ask is, you know, Just Cause 2, the jump from 1 to 2 in that series was kind of similar to Saints Row 1 to Saints Row 2.
Yeah.
Insofar as they really, you know, that they added the grappling hook and they made it about like a farcical South Pacific dictatorship, you know, as opposed to kind of a generic open world kind of thing. It would be a huge miscalculation to reel that back, because when people talk about Just Cause 2, like when you talked about it, it was always with fond regard to those kind of indulgences, right?
Yes. So they already went the way of Saints Row by the second game instead of the third. So we'll see where they go from here. But hopefully they up their voice acting budget and have more lines than "I'm going around" for the enemies to say as they're attacking you. That one gets old pretty quick.
They shout it in a straight hallway that just leads to you.
Yeah. But yeah, so that's exciting if you like Just Cause.
Ben, did you play Just Cause 1 or just Cause 2?
Just Cause 2. Just Cause.
Just Cause as well, or?
Just Cause 2 as well as not playing Just Cause 1. Just Cause, it didn't look hurts. That great.
I'm sorry I asked. Please stop.
You should know when you're like wandering into like linguistic recursion.
This was bad when I started. Okay, interesting.
Eyes wide open, Dennis. You walked right into that. Huh. Yeah, I saw this too. I didn't claim it because I wanted to leave it for you.
Oh, thanks,
yeah,
man.
Yeah. I was it's a shame that they didn't show any screenshots.
They have leaked screenshots of it. So
nice.
We can include that. Let's do that.
That's fine. Yeah. Jala, how about you?
I have a weirdo story because I always have weirdo stories. This one is just something really small and strange. Melissa Etheridge is releasing or has released a mobile game based on her song Take My Number, which is the first single of her new album This Is Me. You basically click on falling guitar picks for points and try to remember the numbers of the people in your contact list. The reason why this is interesting to me is because that's a really weird kind of marketing thing. And to my understanding, I think there's apparently there's other musicians who have gone this route too, using like basically Facebook style app game things as, mm-hmm. you know, ways mm-hmm. to market their songs. Yeah. How does that work exactly? I don't exactly get it. But
it's content marketing. It's creating mm-hmm. value. It's nurturing people in the sales funnel.
I like how as soon as you said content marketing, like I physically felt pain.
Oh boy, you should listen to the sketch on this week's Watch Out for Fireballs.
I just love the assumption that anyone is going to be able to remember numbers from their contact list. Like I barely know my wife's number.
That's a pretty good statement though. I mean, like to be honest. Although the question is it meant to make you feel bad that you don't have this memorized?
Yeah. But like I've got randos from, you know, freshman year of college that I worked on one project with and haven't spoken to since. And I'm like, I put this person in my contacts so I didn't have to remember their numbers.
Yeah. I really ought to go through and purge those people actually, because it's upsetting to have them there.
See, it's one of those things where like my instinct is like, oh, gotta curate, gotta, you know, keep it manageable as if I had a collection on a shelf. But it's like, this takes up 0.0001% of my phone's memory.
Right. But you have to scroll through that. And like when you're trying to type in, you know, the name of your wife, when you type in J-E and you see all these other people, like, like it's taking up 0.001% of your phone. However, it's also taking up mental bandwidth. It is a constant minor irritant. At least I'm speaking for myself here.
No, I get it. That, you know, that's why I've got a favorites page. It's amazing. I have three numbers on my favorites page. One of them is the call-in number for like my work conference phone.
Yeah.
So there's two numbers that I call, and probably 98% of the time, that's all I need.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. So if they want to do that in the game, I can probably, like I said, I can get 50% of them with certainty because one was taught to me as a song when I was three because it's my home number.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the other one I can get with, you know, 70% confidence.
Yeah. I would have thought that that a Melissa Etheridge iOS game would just be the outside of a big apartment building or house, and you have to guess which window is hers. So you can come to it, and if you guess wrong, it's like it yells at you like no, you done fucked up.
Yeah. Wait, isn't the follow-up line though, I'll be home soon?
Well, yeah, you have to, like, they have to wait, and if you wait outside yeah. the wrong one, she never comes, and then you turn into a okay. little skeleton.
You have to, like, break into her window when she's not at home.
Yeah, yeah. You have to jimmy yeah. the lock, go through her pills.
Oh man.
Dark times. Dark, dark times.
We are not going to get backed for this game, but okay.
Kickstarter bloodbath.
As you get done with that presentation, you're like, what do you think, Melissa? And she's just sitting there with her jaw open.
Just reading out in the police. Yeah.
How did you get such an accurate representation of my apartment?
Well, let's just say we play tested this.
Yeah. Method programmers.
Nice. Huh. And finally, Dennis.
Yeah, mine is also marketing related. It's also game related. Assassin's Creed Unity is out, and apparently it is horribly broken. Like, just frame rate is not at all there. The game is just, the way it's been described, is nowhere near ready to play. But the marketing thing that makes it super slimy is that the review embargo was
so
for 12 hours into the game's launch day. So yeah. noon, the day that it launched, which is just blatantly hostile in that, you know, Ubisoft, which generally I've got, you know, like, I love some of Ubisoft's stuff, but they just blatantly, like, suppressed critical analysis of their games until anyone who, you know, I guess isn't thinking about it too deeply has gone out and bought it.
Yeah.
In an attempt to, I mean, there's no other way to describe it than trick people into buying this game.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, you know, I get why embargoes are a good thing. Like, when they function the way they should, mm-hmm. They allow reviewers to go through the game at a leisurely pace and mm-hmm. play to completion and actually, you know, give a better review. But this is an instance, and I feel like it's happening more and more often, where embargoes are being used to delay and trick people.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Just super slimy.
So, like, what Ubisoft didn't want to lose was the people who had stuck with the series thus far.
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah, I'm gonna backstab the people who are, you know, closest to this franchise.
Yeah,
that's a great right? idea.
Yeah,
if they haven't learned from Assassin's Creed 1 or Assassin's Creed 3, I say weeks before I go out and buy the most recent Assassin's Creed. But yeah,
oh yeah, for sure.
Is there really only one good game in the Assassin's Creed series?
There are, like, so far as I know, 3.5 good ones.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which one's the half?
Revelation.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is it, like, shit the bed partway through or what?
Yeah, it does. It does.
Which
kinda...
half is good?
The first half.
All right.
The part where you're running around Istanbul / Constantinople.
Yeah. Which one is?
What's that?
Is it Constantinople? No.
Istanbul was Constantinople.
No, yeah, I know exactly what you're doing. I see it, but I won't sanction it. Hey, they can't all be winners. It's fine.
So that's what I should have done when I asked Ben about Just Cause.
So to it. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a strategy that, like, movie studios have done all the time, right? You know, since the beginning of time, really. Like, if a movie, if they're trying to bury it, they just won't have any like screenings, right? Hoping to trick people on that first or second weekend, which that's getting harder and harder to do because more people are researching this shit for themselves or trusting word of mouth or waiting until there's a substantial enough, like, body of, you know, opinion online to, like, see that. So
yeah, which is, well, I was about to say, which is objectively a good thing. I will say there's an element of groupthink where I think people miss some genuinely good games and games they would otherwise completely enjoy because the reviews are bad. Yeah.
Oh yeah, for sure. Like, I think that the golden zone is, like, between 7 and 7.5. Like, that, like, that is where I want to pay attention to stuff. Yeah. You know, which is at the bottom of the scale. So
yeah.
Yeah, this is, and contrast that with Dragon Age Inquisition, which I saw reviews for it today, and I was, like, getting hyped about it.
Yeah, sure.
I was like, you know, like getting really, really good reviews from people. And then I'm like, okay, so, like, when can I purchase this video game about aged dragons And it's like, no, it's not going to come out for like a week and a half. It's like, damn, that's confidence.
Yeah. Yeah, that's impressive. Although I guess maybe they get the reviews out now so they can get people thrown back to last week to sign up for their EA Origin service. And
that actually makes perfect sense.
Yeah. But I mean, so to do any of that, and again, this is all fine. To do any of that, they have to churn out a genuinely good game. So everyone wins in this situation. Whereas this, embargo, delay, whatever, sleaze tactic is, everybody loses, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So, nah.
Well, I mean, so as gamers, though, if you see a company do this, you should make sure to remember that in the future.
Yeah.
So, I haven't bought another Assassin's Creed game yet. So hopefully I stick to that, but yeah.
There's already been an Assassin's Creed on the current gen of consoles.
Right? Black Flag was it was kind of a straddle.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man, that series is in decline.
Yeah, I heard Black Flag was really good. I got it for free with my graphics card.
I heard the ship part of it was really good.
I've heard good stuff about it in general. Like from the setup all the way to the moment to moment, like the structure of it is pretty great.
Maybe it's like a Call of Duty thing now where it's every other one is going to be good. Only it's without the burden of separate development teams.
Yeah, that actually I think there are like separate development teams on that. They do have the A team and the B team.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, like. they had a team working on Assassin's Creed 3 for several years while they churned out Brotherhood and Revelations.
Yeah.
And I think even like Black Flag was an off year one. Like they were working on Unity. The A team was working on Unity, which.
Interesting that it reversed like that.
Yeah.
I can't remember did which was the B team for Call of Duty, Treyarch?
Yes.
Yes.
Do they turn out any good ones?
Depends on who you ask.
Ah, Ben, I'm asking you.
It depends on how I feel about Nazi zombies. Sometimes, most of the time, not so good.
Yeah,
it's okay.
I just want to stop and contemplate that we live in an age where it's appropriate to have an educated opinion on Nazi zombies.
like a measured, calm, polite opinion on Nazi
zombies. I mean, there are cool like game elements to that game, the Nazi zombies game. Anything in the single player though is kind of garbage though.
Yep.
Infinity Ward, they made a good Call of Duty game.
Yeah.
Cool.
That sounded like a brief to me.
Multiplayer.
Now it is time for the multiplayer where we interact with you, the listeners. Dennis, since you posed the question, I'm going to ask you to pose the question for the show.
Yeah, this tends to be the two things that games are trying to do to you, which is either empower you or disempower you. So we simply asked for the most empowering and disempowering moments from games.
Yeah.
This got like novels worth of responses too, and it's not a bad thing. Like people felt chatty about this. So.
Yes, they did. So
I'm sure there's an insights in there somewhere.
Yeah. I hope people don't mind if we do a little bit of on the fly editing on this, and I'm going to encourage all of the readers here today to do a little bit of skimming so we're not here all night. Not out of disrespect for you, the listeners, who responded in, but that's sometimes a thing we do. I have one here. That was actually sent in via email from Graham via the contact form that is duckfeed.tv/contact, which is another way to do these, saying, without thinking too deeply into it, one of my favorite moments in video games that combines empowerment and disempowerment comes at the end of Super Metroid. Spoiler warning for Super Metroid. The final battle with Mother Brain inevitably leads to her using a whole bunch of overpowered moves to reduce your helpless ass to a single hit point of life. Just as Mother Brain is ready to finish the job, your darling Metroid swoops in and saves the day. Sadly, the Metroid sacrifices itself not only to rejuvenate your life force, but also to give you incredible firepower. It's time to finish off Mother Brain. Using the hyper beam is wonderful. Every shot knocks Mother Brain's head back. It's totally satisfying. Needless to say, the rest of the battle is a cakewalk, but the fun doesn't stop there. After Mother Brain bites the dust, you get a few minutes to hightail it off the planet. The hyper beam doesn't just destroy enemies in one hit, it busts down previously impenetrable doors too. Getting off the planet isn't too easy, but the hyper beam at least makes it work, makes a quick work of most obstacles. Ben, what does Slade say?
Slade says, most empowering would have you feeling that what you're doing is actually affecting the world around you. Least empowering is when game goes into cinema mode and you've got to watch whatever happens, even though in any other situation you could stop what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah. So that actually, like, it brings up something that I'm a little bit curious about, which is stopping what's happening. I think that what feels disempowering about that to me is me wishing that that was a thing that they would let me do.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I kind of wish the game I was playing was the one that you were showing me.
Yeah. that's a great way of phrasing it. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see here. Jala, what's David say?
David says, mass enemy combat in the Arkham games. Something about being able to stroll into a group of 20-plus guys and start picking them off a few at a time with melee and gadgets while countering and dodging just feels amazing. It does a great job of making you feel more powerful than the fodder without making them insignificant, as a large or well-armed group of them can mess you up if you aren't careful.
Yeah.
Yep.
Something I love about the Arkham games is that it's the only series that makes it abundantly clear to you that the enemies are afraid of you.
Yeah.
Yep. Shows their heart rate when you are in stealth mode.
Yeah. And that's so gratifying. Like, I say this and it makes me sound like a psychopath, but I don't inspire a lot of fear in my day-to-day life. And so that is
makes you a psychopath.
That is a novel. It's a novel experience, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I find there's a sweet spot for Arkham games, though, because, you know, it kind of does show off a little bit with, like, the 20-plus guy groups at certain points of the game. That's just, like, a technical prowess thing. But at that point, you're always about to get hit, and so really you're only, at least, and maybe this is just the way I play, but you're really only using the counter moves, because that winds up being the most powerful. And so you're just countering. Whereas if you get the group around to, like, 10 people or so, that's just right, that you're kind of doing regular attacks with counters mixed in instead of kind of being the default.
Yeah.
I think it depends on how you play, because sometimes there's ways that you can ignore the people that are about to hit you by, you know, like either jumping away or hitting them before they hit you, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I prefer the if it ain't broke, don't fix it approach, where it's just like he has little thunderbolts over his head. I'm going to counter him. I know that will work. I'm not going to try to get fancy.
Yeah. And like game designers, if they're just make your melee combat like Arkham. Like if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Like it's so good. I occasionally get a bug under my skin to go play Arkham City again.
I know the first game did. Do they have an arena mode where you can just kind of drop in, do some combat, and jump out?
Yeah, they have challenge maps and stuff.
Yep. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yep.
Dennis, what's Tom say?
Tom says, while there are games that deal exclusively in disempowering you all the time, like horror games, I think the most important thing for both is contrast. One example that gets used a lot and that I'm not a huge fan of is the start fully powered up, get hit in the head, and lose all your stuff trope. What effectively makes you feel disempowered, it's also arbitrary and super video gamey. I would love to see like a list of all the games that do that.
Go to TV tropes.
Yeah.
Like it's there.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he uses Final Fantasy VII as an example. You're chasing Sephiroth and you're not entirely sure what that means. But the game kind of starts feeding you just enough to make the pit of your stomach drop. The serpent in the swamp impaled on the tree, the flashback where Cloud flails helplessly while Sephiroth one-shots everything. It works really effectively because of the context. You know how much damage your party is dealing and how many hit points they have. And this is the guy that you're chasing? The guy who could wipe the floor with you, or excuse me, wipe you all out with a sneeze. That's cool. I didn't know that it did that.
Yeah.
As for empowerment, I think Dishonored was one of the best recent examples for me. The opening prison escape is surprisingly tricky, and things are likely to evolve into a mess as you try to sneak and stab your way past a building full of guards. That feeling of fear and caution dissolving as you gain your powers and start learning, leaping from rooftops, blinking up to windows, and slowing time to a crawl is fantastic. Suddenly, every encounter is happening on your terms, and it's exhilarating.
Yeah.
Hooray! I was actually thinking that as, you know, a good example of both myself. So there you go.
Yeah. Nice. No disagreements there. Let's hear. Gustavo writes in on Facebook saying, in Final Fantasy XIV, there is the last big, long-as-hell story mission dungeon called the Praetorium. In one of the sections, you drive a Magitek armor. And bombard, shoot your way through an evil empire base. It's one of the most empowering moments in the game, especially because of something that happened earlier in the game, I assume relating to the empire and Magitek. Between level 30 and 35, you do a lot of silly quests, like obtaining goblin cheese in order to find this the secret to fight the Lord of Crags. The Lord of Crags Titan. after your battle with him, you return to the base and find most of the secondary NPCs dead and the rest of your group to be captured by the evil Imperials. The quest also has you load up on all of the dead load up all the dead bodies of your companions into a cart so they can have a proper burial. It made all that Imperial general murdering I did later so much sweeter. Did you press X to pay your respects? I'm sorry, I have to keep current with the memes and drop one in. Just so people know when these take place.
Yes, timestamp. We should reference Gundam Style and throw them off.
Yeah. Oh. We did that on those damn Ross kids. Chris fired off Gingham Style, you know, like the pattern of dress, and I was like, I was so happy with that, just because like, oh my gosh, that's ingenious. And I was on a re-listen of my brother and me at the time, and around the time I was getting ready to title that Gingham Style, they cracked the same joke, and I was like, damn it. So
nothing is original.
Nothing at all is original. I think my I'm only going to give a disempowering one for my personal answer, which is to say the original EverQuest back when I was playing that, and I was not privy to the rules of MMOs, and everything kind of felt like the Wild West, you know, the new and open frontier. And that game was so disempowering in general, because it was trying to emphasize group play, which I did not want to do because I am a solitary hunter. and so the notion of, like, you know, one zone away from a city, getting my corpse with all my stuff on it dropped in the middle of an orc encampment that I couldn't get back to without dying again and losing more levels and having to enlist the help, I think it was of a guildmate or somebody at the time, to get in there and drag everything out. Just that notion of needing to ask somebody for help was incredibly humbling in a way. And I kind of, in my mind, always equate that with disempowering, just kind of like, yes, this is not something that you can handle alone. You know, this is not a game that is balanced, you know, for somebody of your disposition, right? And so, like, that was kind of a defining moment in learning what online games are, you know, a little bit all about. And, you know, we're about for several years before everything started getting a lot easier, right?
Before they made everything, like, so softcore.
Yeah, for stupid babies and casuals. Ben, what does Mikhail say?
Mikhail says, an abridged version, nothing beats Dark Souls once you've learned the layout, enemy attack patterns, and mastered the moveset weapons. I really felt this on my second playthrough, remembering how I probably sank 10 hours into the Undead Burg, which is about where I'm at. he's also been playing Saints Row recently. And one thing he mentions is the opening sequence of Saints Row the Third, for instance, does a really good job of making you feel like a carefree badass, setting the tone for a kind of playful empowerment that's different than the patient learned kind in Dark Souls. I really think that it does it better than any GTA game, where playfulness tends to get overwhelmed by misanthropy and cynicism. And then one example he gives for a game that makes you feel disempowered is That Dragon Cancer, which we have an episode about a year ago that we made about it. So he mentions that an aspect of this game will be experiencing a lack of agency when facing certain life events.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah, that's a good example. Yep.
For sure. Yeah. How about you, Ben? Do you have a favorite empowering or disempowering?
I have some for Empowered. Definitely one for Empowered that came to mind was Katamari Damacy. So that was, yeah, I mean, you definitely get the scale on that in the span of about 10 minutes or so. One that makes you feel empowered and disempowered within a 5 minutes span of time is Shadow of the Colossus, which, yeah, at the very ending. And then one example, I guess, of a disempowered that I thought of, Metal Gear Solid Snake Eater. Not to give away any sort of spoilers, but I will give away one spoiler in a general sense. Mm-hmm. Something affecting your sight disempowers you a whole bunch midway through the game. So,
yeah.
That was definitely a disempowering moment that I think lasted the rest of the game. So, yeah.
The rest of the series.
Well, yeah.
If I put my mind to it, and if I ever was crazy enough to take on any more projects, what I would like to do is a stream of the entire Metal Gear Solid series from chronological beginning to chronological end. So to go from Snake Eater to Revengeance. Mm-hmm.
That would be neat.
Yes, it would. But jobs. Yeah, all of those are good examples. Shadow of the Colossus, like even outside of the ending, the moment of, oh boy, I'm never going to be able to eat the whole thing, to wow, I can't believe I ate the whole thing, is a massive gulf that seems insurmountable until you surmount it.
The thing I was thinking of is holding on to the stairs and seeing the pink circle shrink, and it's just like, oh, yeah.
Jala, what's Sam say?
Sam says, there's nothing more empowering than an EYE divine cybermancy when your psychic powers become so powerful that you can kill an enemy by just looking at them and making a werewolf explode out of their body. Disempowerment can be good or bad depending on the game.
Sorry.
One of my favorite moments of disempowerment is the microwave tunnel and final boss battle in Metal Gear Solid 4. It just hits home how old and tired Solid Snake is after decades of bullshit. I like that. Anyway, my least favorite disempowerment is the entirety of Metroid Other M, starting from the tutorial where you follow a bunch of instructions to learn the game's terrible controls to the end when you literally watch a man kill the final boss for you.
Senpai, restrict my beams.
It's funny. I Metroid and Final Fantasy, it feels like, have been brought up a couple times, and I would not have expected those games to really play in that space.
I think those are such guided experiences, or at the very least, Metroid with its narrative beats, and just the fact that it is literally their trope and their shtick that they will take everything away from you at the beginning of the game.
sure.
You know. Yeah, that doesn't surprise me much. Jala, how about you? Do you have any personal examples?
Well, in more general terms, other than Dishonored, basically for empowerment, any new game plus mode for when that was a thing, and also stuff like whenever you find the hidden armor in Mega Man or all the Chaos Emeralds in Sonic or unlock that super magical extra power up thing, that's kind of like an obvious, but nobody mentioned it, empowerment.
I was just gonna, I'll let you finish, sorry.
Well, I was just gonna say, for disempowerment, someone had mentioned about horror games. I was thinking things like the hotel scene in the beginning of Call of Cthulhu, Dark Corners of the Earth, where you are just, you don't have any way to fight back. You just have to run. You don't have, like, you have nothing.
Yeah.
That kind of a thing. But yeah, that's very common with any of the horror, survival horror genre games. So.
Yeah. So for the empowering thing in the new game plus, were you a Chrono Trigger fan?
I did play Chrono Trigger. Yeah.
Okay.
So. Yeah.
That I think I got a lot of mileage out of that new game plus, getting all the different endings.
Yeah. Yeah, that was probably the time that I use new game plus the most, is on that particular game. So.
Yeah. Neat. And then Dark Souls new game plus, which just hits you in the balls all over again. Yeah. Yeah. And finally, Dennis, take us home with Phil.
Yeah, Phil says, the most empowering moment for me would have to be the moment in Super Metroid, again, Metroid, after defeating the first version of Mother Brain, she spawns back to life and completely wipes the floor with you. But once the Metroid sacrifices itself for you, you gain the ability you've never had before, Hyper. With that, you carve through everything that stands before you, and even the music sounds triumphant. The most disempowering moments for me are in any game that teaches you to be a badass with tons of weapons and equipment, and suddenly all of it is stripped away, and you're only left with your wits. Makes you feel helpless, but at the same time a lot more alert of your surroundings. Best examples I can think of are in the Metal Gear Solid series and Metroid Fusion.
There's a particularly egregious sequence in Max Payne where they basically strip you naked and in this fast-paced shooter game expect you to stealth kill people with bats.
Which Max Payne is this?
The first one.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I forgot about this.
Yeah, it was a real sticking point for me. They do that in Half-Life as well, where they take away all of your weapons and toss you into the garbage compactor, and you have to.
Nothing.
Yeah, and it's funny that even though you used the Half-Life 2 gravity gun as the post image.
No one talked about it. Yeah.
Nobody brought that up.
I'm curious because I can't decide if putting something in the image makes it taboo or makes people more likely to mention it. Because I think the Blitz Ball, when I put it in for one of the questions, got a lot of shout outs. But this one, goes back and forth.
Yeah.
I think I would have said Half-Life 2 if it was not the picture.
Yeah. You don't want to be cliche. Man.
It's played out. Yeah.
And nobody mentioned PT when you used that image for the post either.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Which I think I mentioned. I really wanted someone to explain that hallway scare to me, so I had to look up videos for it.
I'm just going to have to bite the bullet, you guys. Oh. Cool. So thank you, everybody, for responding and coming out in force. It seems like we're getting more responses every single time. We really appreciate you guys engaging with us in this way for our content marketing jamboree extravaganza.
Stop.
Sorry. I've got to be in my bonnet, you guys. But if you would like to hop on this, you can go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/thelevelpodcast. And like us there. And on Tuesday afternoons, generally, Dennis puts up a prompt and you reply on a comment.
Yeah, on Tuesday evenings, Dennis likes to respond to the prompt, too.
Oh, yeah.
If he's allowed.
Oh, he does, doesn't he? I was saving that for the stinger. I wanted to give people something to listen to.
Sure,
so go ahead.
I actually thought of one while we were reading these, which I think is now going to be my answer for disempowerment, which is
when your podcast host skips over you.
No, which is the moment towards the end of Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons.
Oh,
and that's all I'm going to say. But that is super disempowering.
Yeah.
And then for empowering, this for whatever reason came to my mind: the final boss battle of Heavenly Sword. You're fighting it in like the midst of a larger battle raging on around you, but your attacks are so powerful that even though you're fighting one enemy, they're sending enemy soldiers just flying all around you. So like every single one of your swings or parries just has these huge kind of wave-like effects on the crowd around you, which just really, really gives things a sense of scale.
So it turns into Dynasty Warriors.
I've never played Dynasty Warriors, but I imagine so. Oh, and I'm going to double up now because I just remembered we have survey results to talk about, and I don't know where to put that.
Yeah, no, put it here. I'm curious.
Yeah, okay.
So give the nice people context.
Yes, so this is apparently a thing now because people love responding to these. We asked how honest people are when they're asked for their birthday to access age-gated content online. And so I asked two questions. The first was, do you enter your actual birthday, including month and day, when asked for it? And then the second question was, what year do you enter? Do you either do a random year, the oldest possible year, or your actual birth year?
Yeah. Before you reveal the results, Dennis, I want to hear your response to this, Jala, because you were not present when we had the initial debate.
I literally just put in my birthday. I don't care. That's whatever. I'm boring like that. I don't lie about it.
Okay.
Play it straight.
An answer. All right. I want to see if that comports with the results.
Yeah. So, this was surprising to me. I thought I was in the minority, but 2/3 of people actually put in their exact birthday, including month and day.
That is ridiculous.
I know. I thought I was in the minority. I'm in the majority. So that's really interesting. Y'all are an honest lot. You know, you should be proud of yourselves, you honest Abes, you.
No, they should be upset because they're not following my example.
That's right. They're not being efficient with their time.
Ben, I forget where you fell down on this.
I always pick a very old year and January 1st because that requires the minimal amount of effort.
The fewest clicks. Right.
Yeah. And then this is my favorite part. So of the people that lie about their year, about 2/3 of them just pick a random year. Just under 1/3 of them pick the oldest possible year. And then one respondent out of 29 does not put in their actual birthday, but still goes to the trouble of entering their birth year.
So it's 1/1, whatever year they were born.
And then your actual year. Yeah. Meeting dishonesty halfway there.
That'd be like your birthday on your resume if you forgot what your birthday was.
Yeah. It's the John Doe of birthdays.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, we need to find more stupid shit to argue about. This is fascinating.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll come across something. I've got a couple ideas already. So people keep on responding to these, so I'll keep on putting them out.
Hey. Yeah, we should put a call to action at the end of that. Get more people looped into our funnel.
Stop it.
All right.
They just start whapping him across the nose with a newspaper.
You guys want to do a grind?
The grind.
It is now time for the grind, where we talk about the games that we have been playing over the past week or so. Jala, as our guest, I'm going to invite you to go first.
Okay, so first off, I finished the rest of the DLC for Dishonored. Woohoo!
Oh, yeah.
And when I was doing this, I had this thought that turned into a small conversation about why is it that anytime there's a painter in media, they're usually batshit crazy, evil, or both? And why is it that anytime there's a villain who paints, you always have to go into the painting and do some kind of bullshit? It happens in Dishonored and Elder Scrolls Oblivion, for example, but I've seen it in other media too, even stuff like Darkwing Duck. So, like, what in the hell is up with this? And the only thing anybody could tell me is, like, oh, here's a positive representation of a painter, is Epic Mickey. That's it.
That's Mickey Mouse is like tofu. So. He takes on the flavor of whatever's next to him.
He's like the Barbie of cartoons.
Yeah. I think, honestly, I think that's a Lovecraft thing. Portrayals of creative types as being more susceptible to cosmic forces from beyond.
Okay, well, whichever.
I'm not saying
anyway,
it's fair.
The point is,
I'm just like,
damn it, I'm a painter playing this game, rolling my eyes, going, yeah, whatever, fuck you guys too. So,
I'm trying to rack my brain for an example of other painters in video games, but I can't.
I threw out the unfinished Swan.
Oh, yeah.
Technically painted.
But that's...
You are the painter.
Aren't you just, like, chasing part of a painting, though? Like, you're not really doing anything painterly, like...
You're splashing paint on stuff. That's basically that's what painters do, right?
you're like a Jackson Pollock character with a limited color set.
Yeah. What about Realm from Final Fantasy VI?
Ooh, nice. Mm-hmm.
There you go.
Yeah, she's a young girl, but she's a force for good. She defeats Ultros by showing him how ugly he is.
Oh,
hooray! Okay, well, anyway, the other game that I played other than finishing up the Dishonored DLC was Hand of Fate, and this is a game that was gifted to me by a fan of my comic, Sailor Moore, and so thanks, Brian. Anyway, this is a game. It's in early access right now on Steam. It was kickstarted sometime last year, but I didn't know about it until I was given this game. So, anyway, it is basically a deck builder that also has fighting stuff. Like, I've seen a description on Steam say that it's Magic the Gathering meets NetHack meets Diablo. And it's actually really kind of neato. It's you versus the, like, some wizard guy or whatever who happens to have a deck of cards, and you fight against him, and you're playing deck that, you know, shows what cards you get as you go through the game. Is just basically as you play the game, you get more cards, and you can select what cards to put in your hand, and then those cards in that hand are randomized throughout the play, you know, as you go through each level or scenario or whatever you want to call it. So it's kind of neat that way. And are you limited to a certain
number of cards in your hand?
You are limited to a certain number of cards in your hand, depending upon which scenario or level or whatever you're on. And the game board, if you will, is basically a layout of cards that are face down. And as you land on each card, you know, different stuff will come up. And then, like, you have different encounters that are randomized that you get to play through. And some of them are kind of role-playing experiences where they're like, you meet this man who says, you know, oh, give me some food for whatever. And then, like, you have to make decisions on what you want to do and go from there. And sometimes you end up fighting monsters and things, like maybe you're ambushed by bandits or something. And when you do, it actually switches to like action mode, and then you get to fight like a, you know, an action game. So it kind of covers like a bunch of different types of games, but it plays pretty well when you're going through. And as you're going from card to card across this map, your food supply runs down, and if you run out of food, you die. But you can come across different instances where, like, if you fight bandits and stuff and you win, then you get food from them. Or maybe you can come across a merchant and you can buy some more food from them and that kind of thing. But starvation is something you have to consider, so you have a limited number of moves in that aspect anyway. Mm-hmm. The first thing I came across when I played the game was a gorge with a skeleton at the bottom that has like a weapon, and you notice that, oh, there's something shiny down there. This guy has a weapon. The sides of the gorge have thick vines that you can climb down, and you can either risk going into the gorge to get the weapon, or you can just keep going. And then at that point, it randomizes four different cards, and three were successes and one was a failure, and it's random, and you just have to select one. And then happen to succeed, then you get the weapon. And if you happen to fail, then obviously, like, you get hurt or something.
Yeah.
So,
is the skeleton alive at the bottom of the gorge? Is it like a skeleton with a sword that's going to attack you?
Well, you don't know that when you first go into the encounter. And I'm sure that if, I'm sure in some of the later encounters, it'll end up being not just failure, but major, you know, epic failure or something. And then, like, on that particular one, maybe the skeleton would come alive and kill you. I don't know. But.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting, though, because it's action RPG-ish with, you know, attacks, dodges, counters, finishing moves, that kind of thing. But it's like the action sequences are short and they're limited only to the fights that you have. And at the end of each scenario or encounter that you, you know, go through through each map, you end up fighting the boss or what have you. And so when you're fighting the boss, that's, again, like another action style setup.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because it does kind of bridge this gap between deck building and, you know, just other more action style games. So it's been a lot of fun so far. I really enjoy it, and it's easy to put it down and pick it back up because since the maps are, you know, here, land on a card, and then, you know, you finish that card out, and then you can just turn off the game and come back, and it'll have saved your spot exactly where you were. So you can pick up and set it down at any time.
Go ahead, Ben.
Do the card outcomes, are there any more complex than just pass or fail? Like, do you get, like, bonuses sometimes, or do you...
Yes, do you there, get epic there are fails? Different... Oh, yeah, there's major successes, major fails. There are randomized elements to it. You can get different armor or weapons or accessories or whatever that give you extra, and sometimes it's just kind of built in that sometimes you'll get, you know, more or less depending. So, and some of the encounters too, like sometimes, like there's an encounter called Mr. Lionel, and you come across a dude named Mr. Lionel, but what he does varies. I've come across him several times, and I've repeated the exact same motions each time, because the first time he gave me stuff, and then the second time he gave me stuff, but the third time he just, like, smacked me in the head, took some stuff, and ran away. And so, like, you know, so you don't necessarily, just because you've seen the card before doesn't mean that it's necessarily going to play out the same way that you think it's going to play out. Yeah. So.
Do you feel like the card and deck building motif is more effective than if they, you know, did something that was more choose your own adventure with a kind of a behind the scenes randomization, and instead of deck building, you were more kind of customizing a character and, you know, picking what you kind of held on to or discarded?
I think at this point, because deck building games and card games like that are something that everybody's pretty familiar with, that it gives it a unique flavor, and it has, like, definitely a visual motif throughout the game, because you know, you're constantly seeing the cards, you know, floating through the air around this magician guy, and you know, like, your whole map is based on cards and stuff. It's mm-hmm. It just kind of lends itself to the kind of theme of the game better than if it was a choose your own adventure. I mean, it has that kind of element to it, and you can, you know, tailor your character a little bit, but it seems kind of like it fits well the way that it's already designed.
Yeah.
I don't think changing that up to something that's non-cards would make it any better, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Yeah, it seems like an incredibly effective framing device at the very least,
mm-hmm.
Around
yeah,
everything.
Yeah, definitely. Like,
as something that combined it all together.
Mm-hmm. And one thing that's neat too is that you can not just pick up and select your deck for the items and stuff like that that you use or that you might possibly come across through each scenario, but then also you can build a deck that is your encounters that you come across. Like, you can pick, okay, I don't want to mess with bandits, but I want to do, you know, this devil's, you know, wager thing or whatever. You can actually pick different scenarios to play through, and some of them are locked, and they are required that you have them in the deck, depending upon, you know, what scenario you're playing through at the time. But then other ones, you have free reign to choose what you want to see come up in your map.
Yeah.
So.
And I don't know how they would implement that without a draw your card kind of thing.
Yeah. So that's what I'm saying, to where it's kind of the way that it's designed fits well together. And I was not so sure what I would think about, hey, it's action RPG-ish, but at the same time, it also has deck building. Like, what? That doesn't quite jive in my brain, but then when you play it, it actually works pretty well. Hmm. So,
deck building is such a good convention for controlled randomness. Like, maybe convention is wrong. Maybe, like, a good balance for it. Like, you know, controlling the set of random things that can happen to you is just a really good way to go about that. I'm almost surprised that we haven't seen it worked into more things. So hopefully this is the first of seen that more often.
Yeah. It's a feature in board games. I know.
Yeah.
And there are plenty of, like, indie and mobile games that use that. I wouldn't be surprised if something bubbles up, actually, to kind of a more established AAA kind of thing.
Yeah, well, this game, you said. Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, this game is, even though it's early access, it seems pretty well polished. and pretty decently balanced. Like, I haven't had any particular problems with, oh, this stuff is glitched out or this is broken or anything like that. None of that's happened to me in this game so far. And I do know that they're intending to release it on PS4. Hmm. So that'll be a thing at some point.
Yeah.
But
this is Hands of Fate, available on Steam and early access for Windows, Mac, and Linux.
Oh, it's actually available on Mac. Yes. Dennis, go play it.
Yeah. I went to it. I thought it's like $15 or something like that, and I balked.
Yeah, it's $25.
Oh, $25.
It's beyond the pale.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Wow. Okay. Well, whenever it goes on sale.
This is what we've become.
It will happen. It's video games are now the clothing model of purchasing.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Well, extra thanks to Brian then for giving me the game. It is expense, so
yeah, that is very nice of him. Yeah. Did you have anything else, Jill?
Nope, those are the two things I've been playing.
Cool. Let's see here, Ben. I'm going to volunteer you to go next.
All right.
Sitting here playing God as I do.
Well, that's fine. So earlier we talked about how every game should have the Batman combat system.
I know what you're doing.
Yep. So this week I finally jumped into current consoles and I picked up a PS4 and Shadows of Mordor.
Oh, congratulations.
Oh, awesome.
So we can try and be current now.
I'm surprised you waited so long to talk about this. Wow.
Yeah.
I don't know why I'm saying congratulations. Like you're going to have a kid or something.
Yeah, no. Nope.
that's cool. Do you like it?
Yeah, so I just got it yesterday, so I've only played it for about an hour so far, but what I played I liked. Basically what sold it on me was a lot of the user review videos of it and talking about the mechanics of the game, and so I've gotten a little bit into that. I can only can talk a little bit about it. I've just gotten into the open world and kind of exploring and doing side missions. But basically you find and kill people and there's a dynamic army that they have that you can hunt down. You can interrogate people. You can turn people into spies for you and have them stay in the army and then try and take down leaders. But you're basically trying to the main story is it's a story of revenge. So you're trying to take down not Sauron. But like one of his military leaders. Yeah. So, yeah.
You're trying to wreak your revenge on the orcs and the Uruk.
Yes.
Yeah.
You're avenging your own death, right?
And your wife and kid. I don't know why your wife doesn't come back as a crazy elf ghost.
You were the only one chosen. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, it's just kind a little of bit.
Kind of still a bummer, yeah. it's as I said, I've only played it for a little bit so far, so I haven't really gotten too deep in it. I've played one regular mission and one side mission. So it has the combat of Batman, it has climbing of Assassin's Creed, the upgrade system similar to Batman, where it unlocks like new abilities, but it's like almost like new gadgets, I guess.
Yeah.
It's not like you're upping stats or anything. It's just unlocking abilities. Yeah.
Is it persistent open world or is it levels? How is it broken up?
So the people in the army will have power levels, and that kind of indicates what level you need to be at to try and take them down. And so you start the game, the lowest ones are at like around 5 or so, and you can manage those. I haven't met any of the higher ones yet, so I don't know what they're at. So to even figure out where the higher ups are, you have to take down the lower level people and interrogate them and figure out information of the other people.
But it's open world where if you somehow knew where a higher up was, you could stumble over to them.
I believe so, but I haven't done that yet. I did run into one person actually. So yes, you can do that. Yeah.
It sounds like he was not. I'm so sorry to interrupt you.
No, it's fine. What are you going to say?
It sounds like Crackdown in that way, actually.
Huh. I never played Crackdown, but...
It's what you're describing.
So. All right. Yeah. I know the premise. I know things about Crackdown. You're the cop, and it's like...
Like each island has a grand criminal master, and you are kind of taking out the smaller generals underneath them in order to weaken their infrastructure, right? Okay. And so you can go after the main person, but they're going to be far stronger than you would like them to be.
Okay.
So how did your encounter with the powerful person go, or did you just establish where they were and then scuttle off to something else?
So I had two. One was in a mission, and the way they set it up, it was kind of like a tutorial where they described what his weakness was and how basically a weakness of a person can change even from time that you face them to the next time you face them. But this person in particular was afraid of these animal types that they have there. I forget what the names of the animals are, but they're basically like lion dogs. And but anyway, so what you can do is you can release them and they will start to chase the guy. And so he'll immediately going into the running away mode. Hmm. And so that way you can just focus on chasing him down instead of fighting through everyone that's around him and then fighting him.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I did that for one person. Yeah. It was cool. The second person I just ran into because I was just walking around, and so it played like an intro video, and it's, you know, this is so-and-so the elf killer or something. And so, but then I just killed him in fighting him. So I don't think he was high leveled or anything. So
I was going to ask how open is it to just being brute force? Like, is it kind of, they all have their trick, like, hey, he's afraid of dogs, so you got to make him run away and you can't beat it unless you use that trick? Or could you have just, you know, fought him and then chased him? And
no, you can straight up attack him. Yeah.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah. And in addition to like having weaknesses, they have strengths too. So like some people will be immune to like arrows, or some people will be, I don't know, they'll have like a really big powerful strike or something, a powerful like finishing move or something. And so you can find out that sort of information too, again, by like interrogating minions. So
nice. Yeah.
It's just fascinating to me that all of this seems to be procedurally generated.
Yeah. And so part of the incentive for getting current gen console is apparently the Nemesis system is what it's called or whatever. Yeah. Apparently that's the feature that's going to be scaled back on for their release of it on PS3.
Yeah.
But so I haven't seen any persistence yet because I've managed to kill everybody that I found so far. But yeah, I'll update you guys with that as soon as I play more of it and find out more about it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
Yeah. That's exciting.
Yeah.
Neato.
What's your experience with the PS4 in general?
I've seen the menu screen. It's blue, but that's about it. I haven't got PSN yet, so I'm going to try
profound.
And hold out. Yeah.
You get some good stuff if you get PlayStation Plus this time around.
Okay.
I want to say
what do you get?
Binding of Isaac Rebirth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm blanking on it. There's a list somewhere.
Yeah.
Okay.
But Binding of Isaac is one of them.
That seems like a really good game to have on your Vita, actually.
Yeah, I'm pumped because I have it now. I haven't cracked into it, but it's Binding. Yeah. Did I say it's Rebirth?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm excited to crack into that.
Yeah, it's real good.
Cool.
Nice. Yeah, so definitely keep us posted. At least one of us is now current.
Yes.
so that is always good to know. Yeah. Dennis, how about you?
Yeah, I've got a quick brag playing Hearthstone. In arena mode, I finally got to 10 wins, which is a huge milestone. I think it caps you out at 12, so I was almost all the way there. But I've discovered just as there's like a meta in the game, where kind of, you know, what cards and deck styles are popular, so you can kind of build your deck to counter those. I think there's also a meta in when you play the arena. Because it's like, you know, if you do that 11 to 12, 30 window, when all the people who are just kind of casually into it are online anyway, you get a lot more easy matches than if you do it like in the middle of a weekday and it's only the people who do it professionally who are in the arena. So, but I was very excited about that. So that's my quick brag.
I love that determining when to play games online, you just have to pause for a second and think, what would a teenager be doing right now?
Basically, yeah. But then I've been playing Fat Princess, the actual Fat Princess, and not the the match 3 game that I was so down on last week.
Yeah, not the engaging content.
Oh, God. But no, I'm going to stand by. I think it's a genuinely good thing that you could play this game for, you know, 2 hours and get $15 worth of more game, especially when it's, you know, it's not a standout match 3 game, but it's a passable match 3 game. Yeah. And we're all passing time, you know, on commutes anyway. So,
okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's awesome. We got the game for free. Mm-hmm. I've only played it co-op with Jen, and you can play co-op online, which is nice. And it's basically one giant game of capture the flag,
yeah.
Where the flags are princesses that can be made harder to move by making them fat. So it's got a really cutesy aesthetic, only everything gushes blood when it's hit.
Yeah.
And it's got a super, super grating, annoying announcer that just does memes. Just absolutely horrible. They made one soundbite for when enemies get into your base, and it's, "Dudes are in your base, killing your dudes." And I just want to throw my control.
Wow, that's a vintage meme.
Yeah, like it's not even current. And I don't know when Fat Princess came out. It was pretty, you know, it was quite a while ago. But my gosh, like it's just horrible. And then they've only got one soundbite for if a princess gets captured. And if she gets returned, and given that it's, you know, the kind of hardest part is getting her out of the original base, then it becomes a little bit more dynamic. But there's lots of the princess will get kind of captured and then immediately returned because there's some Rambo who goes in, gets just far enough to touch her and then gets killed. And so you just constantly throughout the match here, "The princess has been captured. The princess has been returned. The princess has been captured. The princess has been returned." I just want to turn the announcer off. but despite all of that, the game of it is a lot of fun. You're kind of this little minion in a war. There's probably, you know, 20 people on a side. So alone, you can make very little difference. And it's one of those things where this is not a Call of Duty where with enough skill, you can kind of ramble your way in and get a pentakill and, you know, whatever.
It's class-based, right?
Kind of.
Hat-based. Yes, it's hat-based.
Hat-based, yeah. There are different classes, and it's, you know, like one is the warrior, one is the worker, one is the healer, one is the ranger. And so they all do kind of play a role. No one class is powerful enough where if you're up against two of the enemy, you're going to win consistently. Mm-hmm. So it's not like you can get really good at a class and just own people. Like, you are always going to have to use numbers and teamwork and coordination to win the day. And there's a little bit, you know, if you kind of position yourself smartly, you can take out multiple enemies on your own. But you know, you tend not to live too long, and there's a lot of respawning, which is, you know, it's just the way the game is designed. So that's not frustrating.
Does it put you in timeout for too long between rounds?
No, it's like a 5 second countdown. So like you die and 5 seconds later, you're right back in the action. The annoying thing though, is like you said, it's hat based for the classes. And it's great, you know, if you capture an outpost, you can respawn at that outpost, but there are no hats at the outpost. And so there is no point in spawning at an outpost because without a hat, you have like 2 health, which, you know, like a normal character, a class will have 5 health. So you've got this tiny little bit of health and no meaningful attacks, and it's just pathetic. So I don't understand why the outposts are there, because you always, if you have the option, want to spawn back at your base.
Yeah.
But when you can get that teamwork and coordination working, it's a ton of fun. So the way Jen and I played is Jen was the warrior, I was the healer. And I would just kind of lock onto her. And especially in the maps that tend to have kind of narrower passageways, we'd just be like, this passageway is on lockdown. No one goes through now. And and just kind of played our role, right? And the larger game would unfold around us. But, you know, we kind of had our role to play. And I would heal her. She would hurt others. And it worked really well. So it was a ton of fun. And I would love to find out what happens if you're playing with a group of 4 people or a group of 6 people. Like, I can see this being, if you can get a band of friends playing and running around as a group, mm-hmm. you would absolutely dominate. And it would just be a ton of fun. Yeah. So
I can't decide what would be more fun, like to play against a group of friends or to play alongside them. Like,
yeah. You
know, if there was a group of six people and we just did 3-on-3, that seems like it'd be more fun than playing against strangers.
I would agree. I don't think they have any maps that are small enough to facilitate that. But the principle of the thing is absolutely right. Like, you know, if you're playing against people that you know, it would be really fun. You just need something that it's really designed around having at least 10 people on a side.
Yeah.
As evidenced by if there's not someone on your team, or if there aren't enough people on your team, it'll fill the space with bots. Mm-hmm. And the bots are actually really competent. Like, in normal play, it doesn't have icons above everyone's head who's a human. And in the frenzy of things, you're not paying a lot of attention to who's human and who's a bot. They tend to function pretty equally. And again, they're kind of, the individuals are very easy to kill. And so there's, you know, it's not designed to have one character use a ton of skill to do well. It's more the coordination.
Yeah. So that said, this is, you know, a pretty old game in the scheme mm-hmm. of things. They're giving it away for free after all. Were you able to tell, is there still like a population of people playing, you know, like were you finding actual humans to play with?
Yeah, so it never gave us trouble jumping into a game, and I would say no game that we played was completely full on both sides, but at least half the teams were full.
Yeah.
Half the teams were real people, and you know, so it's like 60% real people, 40% bots on the team, which again the game is designed so that's not a hindrance, and it's still a ton of fun.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's great, and I would encourage anyone who either has the game and wants to try it again, or feels like playing a match three game for a bit, or wants to straight up buy it. Like, I think it would be a ton of fun to play with a group. So,
yeah.
So let's get on that.
So the concept of it is really novel, right? Like, I like the idea of them building a fiction around a flag that gets harder to capture, like actually building in, I'm going to use a WAF term here, a defensive vocabulary that is not just posting up, like that you can actually, you know, shore up. This thing in order to, you know, make defense kind of a viable strategy in a capture the flag. I kind of wish they chose a different theme around it, though. Not so, like the misogyny is, you know, like, oh, you know, like ladies and cake, am I right? You know, that's a little bit there. However, I think the thing that bothers me more about it is that somebody looks at that premise, you know, like, okay, we're going to make her fat, and just gets rock hard at it. Just because
are you saying people shouldn't be attracted to fat ladies?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying there's
what you're saying.
No, there's a very specific that. Okay, I'm gonna give you a peek into the matrix here.
I'm questioning the idea of a fat princess fetish.
No, it's specifically called. I'm gonna pierce the veil here and actually reveal some knowledge of internet sexual subcultures here. But feeders and gainers is what that is called, which is it is a variation on BDSM, where one person is responsible for making another person get a lot bigger. Which this kind of plays into that.
We're way up our own asses right now. It's not that complicated.
I know it's not. I just wanted to find the most delicate way to phrase it with citations and whatnot.
Sure. Yeah. And again, this is, you know, there's the greater culture of, okay, you're always rescuing the princess, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I don't think there's anything malicious going on.
I don't think there's anything malicious about it. I'm just upset that there's somebody whacking it to fan art of this right now.
There are so many steps you had to go through to get to that. You really wanted to bring that up. I mean, to be fair, she's hungry and she's asking for cake.
Okay,
so
cool.
This is a consensual whack fest.
Because who does? Come on, that's just unnecessary, Dennis.
I mean, you've got swords and you've got stuff that you're whacking people with. That's all.
Yeah. You know, who doesn't want cake? Like, I, you know, it's hard to say no to cake.
Yeah, it is. So I've been playing that, and I think I'm going to put a nail in that coffin.
Okay, that's Fat Princess.
Yeah, Fat Princess, good times. Another co-op game we've been playing is Horde. which I would love for you to tie this to something sexual. You fly around as a dragon, and you kind of there are towns and that sprout up and wagons that go between the towns that carry money. And it's kind of a zoomed out top down. So the distance between a town takes you maybe, 5 seconds to fly between them. And your job is to destroy as many of these wagons and carry as much money back to your hoard as possible. Mm-hmm. The game starts off slow. The towns are small. You're slow and there's not much going on. But as the towns grow bigger, they send out more, more carts. They'll send out thieves to try to steal from your hoard. There are also castles that sprout up and knights that come from the castles specifically to hunt you. And all this stuff going on. And so it kind of escalates very quickly to where there's a lot of resources flying around, but you've just got to keep track of a ton of different things to maximize your score. It's a very arcadey. Mm-hmm. And one interesting design choice is that the field that you're playing on is set up as if it's on top of a table. Like there's a wooden table under your play field. Oh. But the field itself is not necessarily like made out to be a board game. And so it's just this, someone was like, throw a table under it. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that looks about right. But anyway, you can play it to co-op. So two dragons both trying to build up your hoard. And you get a multiplier if you go a certain amount of time without dying and without being stolen from. And so the game is really all about being aggressive and efficient in bringing in more money without letting anyone steal from you, without getting killed, which obviously getting killed and being aggressive are in direct contradiction with each other. there's not much to the game other than that. You can get some power-ups. There are certain different enemy types. But really, it's just flying around, breathing fire on stuff. And trying to get a high score, which is a ton of fun.
So it's the opposite of any given Dungeons and Dragons dungeon crawl.
Yeah. You are the dragon going out from the dungeon.
Yes. You are the dragon. It is your dungeon.
Yes, exactly.
I don't know why I started that like a Maya Angelou poem.
No, you need to speak a little more breathily, and then it's real poetry.
No, that's ASMR. And
damn it, you did tie it to something sexual.
are you getting tingles? that is my like break in case of emergency retirement button is to do an ASMR podcast about like Supernatural and Minecraft. Just like really rake in those dollars. Feel filthy, filthy, filthy. The newest addition to the network.
Yeah.
Oh, Lord.
I'm sorry, Jala. Am I dismaying you?
No.
Visions of what could be. But yeah, it's a ton of fun. And it's a nice little, the rounds are 10 minutes long, so it's time bound. And it's a ton of fun. Just hop in and play and then hop out. There's a lot of different maps, but we kind of stick to the vanilla one. I'm sure we'll branch out to the other ones at some point. And then there's also competitive modes where you can steal from other dragons' hordes, and you've got separate hordes, which is also interesting. So I think there's a lot of depth there that we haven't gone into yet. But at its heart, just kind of that central mechanic is different than what I've seen before. This kind of, bringing resources back to your base in the way that they do it. It's pretty unique.
Nice.
Yeah.
You're playing this. Is this a PS3, you said?
PS3, and I think it's on PS4? I'm not sure. Yeah. Or sorry, PS4, PS Vita, all that stuff.
Yeah.
It's a PlayStation game. And okay. I think it's PlayStation exclusive.
I have
the controls.
I have a game called Horde in my Steam library, but
Horde is kind of a generic title. I wouldn't.
Yeah,
it controls like a twin stick shooter. Mm-hmm. So I'd be interested to see, unless they said like, "Hey, this is a game that you probably want to use a controller for."
Yeah,
how they did that.
This just because I own a game does not mean I've played it. I would have to take a look here. Sorry, I didn't mean to.
Yeah, no, it's cool. And if anyone has leads on why they made it on top of a table, mm-hmm. I would be very interested to hear that because it's just a really random element.
Yeah.
But co-op mania for me.
Cool. Yeah, no, that's great. Do you find you get the? Do you find that you guys have time to play together like that with Luke, just as he is conked out?
Yeah, and he does a really good sitting in our laps. He shits in our laps as well, but sitting in our laps. Or just, we have like various bassinets and bouncy seats nearby that he does pretty well in. Jen, is nursing right now, so she nurses and pumps, which means a lot of time kind of locked in position on the couch.
Yeah.
And so video games are a really easy thing to do while you're kind of sitting there pinned down.
Nice.
So that works really well. And geez, when we were trying to get a platinum on Rayman Legends, we probably spent at least a half hour a day playing that co-op. So it's amazing the kind of places time springs up.
Yeah. I'm looking at a gameplay video of Horde on Steam, and it appears like it matches your description.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Interesting. Like it's based on a table.
Yeah. Probably one of those, like, you should really play this with the controller games. Cause it would be unplayable with mouse and keyboard, I think.
Nice.
Cool. Yeah.
Is that all?
Yeah, that's all for now.
Cool. So I'm last. I'm going to try not to keep us here for too long. However, I do have two outside of video game media things, not so much discuss in depth, but at least recommend. The first one is I went and saw Birdman over the weekend.
Yeah.
every time I go see a movie, I feel incredibly guilty about not working. But I wanted to see this one badly enough. It is really good. It is fantastic. In a way, I am bound to like it because it is a story about creation and creativity and fundamentally broken people. For as much as I like watching movies and reading stories about people making things, you would think I would make something myself. But
said the man who has like a podcast for every day of the week.
Yes. Touche. But it's fantastic. It is enthralling on both a technical level because in case anybody is not aware, it is shot to look like it is one long continuous shot.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It is the cinematographer from like Children of Men and Gravity, so you will see his fingerprints on it. But this is it's a 2-hour long movie, which is pretty long to sit still and watch something. But the novel ways that they find to keep that thread going, like that is a story in and of itself. That and, because it is a story about a crazy person, most of the music is diegetic within the scene. So it's all percussion based. And sometimes there's just going to be a dude playing a drum in the background of a scene.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Have you seen it, Ben?
I have.
Okay, cool. So good. Like, it was between that and Interstellar, and I know that you're probably disappointed in me for not seeing Interstellar first.
I saw both.
Oh.
It is a movie that I cannot find a criticism with.
Interstellar or
Birdman.
Okay. Yeah, I mean it's a bit of a it's well trod ground, right? Like story about it's not superhero at all. He's talking about he's making a play. Like, hey, everybody, let's put on a show. And the troubled production that is a common thing. But the way that they approach it is really good, and the performances are fantastic. Like, it has been a very long time since I've seen Edward Norton in anything.
Yeah.
So that was a welcome treat.
I listened to an NPR interview with him about the movie, where the lady really wanted to make the connection between him not coming back to Hulk and playing a failed superhero in Birdman. And you could tell he was just kind of like, oh, I hadn't thought about that. No, I don't think they really played it. And she just kept on pressing him for like the next 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Until he was like, okay, fine, maybe. Sure, why not?
Was he talking to, were they talking to Ed Norton or Michael Keaton? That's every review of it that I read after the fact was to, like, talking that up about how even the casting is an in joke. But it's like, I don't know, like that just seems like superficial compared to what they actually do in the thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and the way it, like, it wasn't the character who plays Birdman didn't want to come back as Birdman. It's not at all a comparable situation to what happened with him and Hulk.
Michael Keaton actually he turned down Batman 3.
Oh,
yeah. Edward Norton, he plays, he's separate. So it is two actors who left behind superhero movies to do something else for personal reasons.
Got it. Norton was a little more involved in the creation of the movie than just acting, though, right?
He left the Marvel universe over disagreements with the way that they had the character, you know, were taking the character.
Oh, no, sorry. In the creation of Birdman, he not a director. But he had something more to do with it. And this is, we are out of video game territory. I do not know what the hell I'm talking about. I'm going to shut up now.
I have no mooring. In addition to that, a book recommendation I would like to make. It is a book called Wolf in White Van. This is written by John Darnielle of the Mountain Goats. And it is staggeringly beautiful. Like, it is related to games. Insofar as the main character is a guy who suffers some nondescript accident and as a result becomes this shut-in who runs this decades-long sci-fi role-playing game that is played by male.
Huh. Mm-hmm.
And the entire book, at least so far that I've read, is kind of about the allure and the downfalls of, you know, internal worlds, like, you know, somebody like living a completely internal life like that. And boy, like John Darnielle, you know, by listening to his lyrics, you can tell that he can write imagery, you know, like that is one of the best things about listening to any given Mountain Goat song. But holy crap, does that come through in this? It is great.
What's it called again?
Wolf in White Van. It's real short. Like I got about halfway through it today. Jury is still out, but that is somewhat related to games. So I wanted to bring it up here as well.
Hmm.
In terms of actual games that I've been playing, putting aside the Phoenix Wright DLC, because people have heard me talk enough about that, and putting aside the Devil's Attorney, which is not any different. Tonight I played the new game by Freebird Games. Those are the people who did To the Moon. Kind of 16-bit looking adventure game, visual novel about recovering memories and creating fake ones that is incredibly emotionally affecting. Their new game, which just came out here this week, yesterday or today, is called A Bird Story.
Okay.
Yeah, and it looks and plays very similarly to the Moon. They're very obviously working in RPG Maker. And it is a like 1 hour game ish that kind of tells a visual story, a narrative. You're playing a young boy who, you know, whose parents are not around. He doesn't really fit in at school. He passes his time by making paper airplanes, and he finds a bird with a broken wing. And the entire arc of the game is about kind of their evolving relationship and what that kind of says about him and the way he interprets the world around him. And in a lot of ways it feels hand catered to me, which is a subdued, dreamlike, melancholic narrative that uses equal parts little kid logic and magical realism to tell an affecting and ultimately heartbreaking story about a bird. So
you've seen the movie The Fall, correct?
Yes.
All right. Yeah. Is it similar to that in style?
So not so much in style. It's a lot more muted. I think The Fall just hits you over the retinas with astonishing imagery from beginning to end. I think that what this does in terms of magical realism, as compared to that, is it matches up locations. So like it starts out, you are kind of going through different parts of this kid's routine. And part of it is kind of like cycling back through it. So it's, you know, wake up, you know, on the first day you are, you know, I'm going to grab this muffin out of the fridge. I'm going to, you know, make sure that I grab everything, but it starts mashing stuff up and you know, and as time starts moving quicker, it's like, I'm not just waking up and walking out of the apartment and going through the wooded path to the school. It is, I'm, you know, waking up and my bed is in the woods. And I'm walking through the door and, you know, like through an amalgamation of the woods and my apartment and the school until I get to my desk and, you know, so on and so forth after that, as kind of this kid's priorities change as he starts caring more and more for this bird and caring less and less about kind of being alienated in other parts of his life. But yeah, the fall is a pretty good comparison, because it is about a way that a little kid interprets, stuff around him that he can't really understand. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know what else to say about it. It's told entirely without dialogue. It's all visual cues and things like that. It's fascinating to see how far they can stretch character acting. In sprite based graphics like that, it looks, 16-bit, except for, some of the modern touches that RPG Maker lets you do with, various lighting shaders and things like that. So it is a little bit more lush than the resolution would have you believe. But the what it's able to squeeze out of a couple of frames of animation is a remarkable, study in kind of economy, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that it does a great deal with very little. All of that said, this is probably not going to be for somebody who is frustrated by a lack of interactivity. I'm kind of, there are situations where I'm bummed out that it takes control away from you, or it's just like, okay, is there an array of arrow keys on the screen? Otherwise, I'm just kind of looking at stuff happening. So you have to have a tolerance for that kind of thing. That said, the bones that they throw you, they're at one point, and this is a little bit of a spoiler, but there are other things like it, so I'm not giving up the entire plot, which is like you have a competition to see who can jump in the most puddles with the bird, and it gives you like a little jump button. So it's a bunch of adorable little press this button to feel something stuff like that. it does a lot with the hour that it gives you. But it is far less interactive than even, say, a To the Moon, which is, something that I really love, a series of environments that let you do personal archaeology, because the way that plot works is you are going around and finding significant items and learning of their significance to this moment in that person's life. And by learning that, you are figuring out how you can actively insinuate the memory that they want to have in that particular place. So the story is revealed, through the individual scientist characters in a very satisfying way there. That doesn't happen here. There is no search or exploration element to this. You're very much kind of hitting the marks that it wants you to hit, but it's a fun ride nonetheless.
Yeah, that's surprising that they do the story without any dialogue. Because if I remember, To the Moon, at least the beginning, was very dialogue heavy, I thought.
Yeah, and it's great to see them stretching that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Dennis, did you ever play To the Moon?
I don't think I did.
Yeah. Jala?
Nope.
Oh. It's great. It gutted me. Granted, it's not that hard to make me cry at something. So, yeah, I think go back and listen. It was in DTR days, but over one weekend, I played both that and Dear Esther.
Ooh. Oh Lord!
I think I just wanted to feel something, guys. Yeah.
Apparently.
Yeah. Any questions about that? I feel like I kind of blew right through it.
No, I think it makes sense.
Yeah, it's called A Bird Story. Just go ahead and buy the soundtrack because it's fantastic.
Did you pick it up on Steam or?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And the studio is really fascinating because they kind of really seem to take things at their own pace. They did To the Moon several years ago, and they have been talking about a follow-up to that for a while now. And that kind of seems to be the case with this as well, where they just kind of are moving at a very leisurely pace.
Hmm.
Yeah. Oh, well.
I wonder what the, because, they clearly AAA games are subject to the churn of you got to get it out on schedule. And then oftentimes an indie studio, you don't put your game out, you don't eat, really. So I wonder what situation these people have that they can kind of just really bide their time with the games they're putting out.
I don't know. Maybe they just there is such a thing as a lifestyle business, right?
Mm-hmm.
These are not unpopular games, and they are an international studio, right? So either they're, raking in more than they need compared to their cost of living wherever they're based out of, or because they are so small, they don't really have a, they don't have that overhead that's necessary. They're not necessarily supporting a huge infrastructure with it. Right?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. It's just interesting to me because I mean, it seems to be putting out high quality games. So
yeah,
I'm all for more of that.
I like them. And looking at their website right now, there are more of them than I thought there were, at least compared to the last time I looked at them, which admittedly was when I last played To the Moon. So I'm kind of curious to dip into that. Yeah, so that is A Bird Story.
Neato.
Good stuff.
Yeah. You guys want to button it up?
Do it.
The credit. So that was level number 83. Thank you so much, everybody, for joining us on this little journey from talking about, you know, feeding ladies to wherever we ultimately ended up, birds, I guess.
Yeah. And that was whatever that was. Yeah.
And so on in that fashion. Yeah. But let's see here. What is there? Most pressing right now, we have the Duckstream event coming up a week from when you're listening to this. If you're listening to it on the day that it comes out, that is November the 21st through the 22nd, starting at 6 Pacific, 9 Eastern on Friday, going through to 6 Pacific, 9 Eastern on the following day. I received my copy of Haunting Ground to play in the morning, and we're still trying to figure out what we're going to do in the evening during our shift. But yeah.
So I'm trying to figure out, will that go into Saturday evening, or will you be done Friday morning?
So that is a 9-hour game, so I should be done by 6 p.m. our time.
And will that conclude the 24 hours, or there will still be kind of...
Yeah, we are closing up shop.
Okay, so I will be a closer for that.
Yes, you're going to be it's an anchor.
Closer. What other analogies can we throw at that?
Something batter. I don't know. Yeah.
Sweet.
We've left video games. I'm without mooring.
Yep.
Yeah. So that's going to be pretty exciting. What am I looking at here? Jala, where can people find you and your work?
On neonskystudio.com or on Facebook/neonskystudio.com, Twitter, Neon Sky Studio, all over the place.
Yeah.
Same thing, all over.
You are prolific. Yes. Yeah. And then go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, with much more to come.
Yeah. Yes.
Lots of plans for new things coming out later. Nice. So
cool. And then for us, just all the usual: Facebook, iTunes, Patreon. You know the drill. Thank you, everybody, for sticking around. Let's close things up. I've been Cole Ross at Cole Ross on Twitter.
I've been Dennis Furia at D Furia on Twitter.
I am and always will be Jala Chan everywhere. Except when I'm Neon Sky Studio.
Who are you then? Oh, never mind.
I am the entity.
Yes, that's right. I am Ben Merkel. I'm at Merkelizer. Merkelizer at Twitter.com.
Yeah, yeah. And let's see here. Senpai, restrict my beams.
Feeling tired today?
Yeah. So my little seasonal affective disorder light has worked really well for me, and so I just, with my birthday money, I don't really need or want any games. Not that I'm going to be able to play them for the next 2 months anyway because of Morrowind.
Don't say that on the podcast, but okay.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I will not. I thought, okay, if one fruity witchcraft light works for me, I'm going to get another one. So my birthday gift to myself was one of those alarm clocks that lights up.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, you know, to bring you into the day, and also it's one of the fancy ones that like mimics a sunset too. So when you're ready to go to sleep, you can set that on and it takes you away. Because both the act of falling asleep and waking up are horrible, uncertain ordeals for me, because you never know when it's going to happen.
Especially now that it's dark when you wake up, and it's, you know, well, it's always dark when you go to bed, but
yeah.
It especially sucks when it's dark when you leave for work, and it's dark when you come home from work.
Precisely. And so I think that I was so excited about waking up to this new and delightful sensation, this new experience, that like a kid on Christmas morning, I woke up at 4 a.m. and was laying there awake, like, you know, trying to fall back asleep as this thing slowly over the course of a half hour lit up and went from red to bright yellow, filling the room as I was aware of every single, like, ratchet up on its iteration through the dimmer.
Nice. Was it glorious?
I mean, it wasn't supposed to be like this. And then I just waiting there watching it click up minute by minute, knowing that when it hit 7:30 that it was going to start playing a nice little tune and I'd hear birds singing. And then even though I was fully awake, I tapped on it because it's like a big globe kind of thing, and when you tap it, it snoozes. And I was like, okay, in 9 minutes. And I sat there looking at this thing fully lit, watching the clock tick up until 9 o'clock, when the birds started back up over the course of 90 seconds.
I just like your retinas are all burnt out for the day because you've been staring into this light.
Yeah,
it's beautiful.
Me laying there on the edge of a queen size bed, just staring at this thing on my nightstand, 12 inches away from my face. So I don't think this worked out like I wanted it to, you guys.